91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we visit with the fermenter of the most provocative cultural battle in South Florida history. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Liberty City's Luther Campbell and his onstage character, Luke Skywalker, played brinkmanship with authorities. He pioneered a hip-hop business model that earned millions. He was the rapper who your mother most feared. A county sheriff wanted Luther Campbell arrested before cameras. That bust led to Nightline and sparked censorship debate. Luther Campbell is now 54. His irreverence hasn't slowed much. Now a football coach, he's written a memoir called The Book of Luke, My Fight for Truth, Justice, and Liberty City. That's next after news. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. It's our Monday edition, Bonnie.
It is, and this hour we visit with Miami's own Luther Campbell. He was born, ironically, in Miami Beach at Mount Sinai Hospital, but he grew up in the environs of Liberty City. A strong family taught him to rebel against racial barriers, and that he certainly did.
In the late 80s and early 90s, Luther Campbell's Two Live Crew challenged authority far more than any rocker did. His obscenity arrest in Broward County garnered national attention and debate. Later, a copyright use case was won in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Luther Campbell has written it all down in a new book called The Book of Luke, My Fight for Truth, Justice, and Liberty City. And we welcome to our studios.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you aren't far from home.
Well, that's right? I was going to say, you know, what's it like? I know you're doing the book tour and stuff, but here you are. You're a stone's throw from Overtown. You're a few miles from Liberty City, your home. How does it feel to be here doing this?
Oh, it feels great. It feels great. You know, that's what I was telling the publisher and the PR people that's working. I'm like, look, I got to get back home, you know, because, you know, it's great, you know, being in New York and Minnesota and all these different other places promoting the book, but it's more important to be here than there. You know, I can always go there and do the work, but the book is about Miami.
Oh, yeah.
Can you believe Jumbo is closed?
I know, right? I remember being a little kid in the back seat of the car, and my mom would take us to Jumbo's, and she would have to go to that back window to get the food. And it was iconic place.
Well, Luther, you know, talking, you do a lot of history in the book at the beginning mm-hmm. and throughout, actually, about Overtown, Liberty City. You know, many of us are familiar with it, but many of us aren't. Mm-hmm. So give us a little of that history, would you?
Well, the history of Overtown and the history of Liberty City, like I speak about it in the book. I mean, you know, Miami in general, I mean, we open up talking about it was 40%. Bahamian African Americans here in Miami, because, you know, the average person, you know, I'm speaking to a crowd at National Black Book Convention in Atlanta, and I'm like, how many people went to Miami? And yeah, we went to Miami. And then I asked the question, how many of you all know that Bahamians built Miami? You know, and it was at one point, it was 40% African Americans here, and on the city seal, nobody knew that. Then I would then ask another question, and I would talk about Fisher Island. How many do you all know that right. Fisher Island was African-American, owned Fisher Island? Nobody knows that. You know, Darcy, the school is named after Darcy. So it was important in order to talk about my history, but also talk about the history of Miami, because it's all twofold. It comes in one big circle. I am who I am because of the history of Miami. And
Dorsey was the first black millionaire, of course.
He was the first black millionaire, exactly.
Well, doesn't Oprah still have a place on Fisher Island?
Yeah. And I guarantee you, she don't know Dorsey. if she knows that, she would be trying to buy buy it back.
Well, but tell us a little, you know, about the 95 cutting through Overtown, yes. destroying Overtown. Liberty City was segregated. A lot of people don't know that.
Yes, yes. And that is why it was important to add that into the book and talk about that. And talk about, you know, Overtown being an historical black area, you know, is one of the areas, you know, that obviously is still trying to hold a fight even right now today with, you know, with them building the Freedom Tower? The new building in Overtown.
Oh, the big gambling thing.
Exactly.
And the advertising tower.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
right.
That's it. Okay.
So it's you know, I talk about Overtown in the sense of Overtown was a place where it was the hotels, it was the entertainment, everything that you had on Miami Beach, you basically had on Overtown. And then when all of the African American performers would come and perform on Miami Beach, they couldn't stay on Miami Beach because they had to be off the beach after 6 o'clock. And they would then move over to Overtown. And Overtown,
Sir John.
Exactly. It would be this vibrant area. I mean, discovering, you know, top acts like Betty Wright. And then when the gentrification came, you know, and they started bringing people down here to then, okay, take over this area, what ended up happening is they took that I-95 and ran it right through Overtown to kill the African-American community and then move those people who were in Overtown to Liberty City. And when those folks moved to Liberty City, then and Liberty City, not a lot of people don't know Liberty City, where my mom and dad live. It was, you know, and I talk about it in the book. It was a predominantly white area, you know, and across the wall it was Liberty Square Projects. And people don't even know right now. I hear people, you know, make the comment, "Oh, that's the Pork and Bean Projects," you know. They don't know where that term came from. The term came from, you know, the whites on the other side of the wall. They said the only thing they could afford in those government houses is pork and beans. So they named it pork and beans. So I always try to correct people who don't know the history and don't know where that name came from. That's Liberty Square Projects.
A remnant of that wall still stands.
It still stands. And same thing as in Coconut Grove as well.
And also your dad, they gave them an opportunity to buy a house, putting down $500, which he had to fight to get.
Yes, yes. He had to, you know, and I talk about it in the book where, and people don't know these stories, when he went to go give the $500 to put down on the house, that he, you know, at the end of the day when they saw he was a black guy, it was like, oh, no, you know, no. They were basically trying to renege on selling him the house, and he had to fight just like every other person in that neighborhood had to fight.
We mentioned at the very beginning that you were born at Mount Sinai Hospital. Mm-hmm. I want to know, and because you said most, you know, people were being born at Jackson Memorial. Mm-hmm. So, but why did you never ask your mom why you were born? Why were you born at Mount Sinai?
Let me tell you.
On 63rd Street on the beach.
Exactly.
43rd.
Yeah, 43rd.
Is it 43rd?
43rd, yeah. And what is it? Is it still all?
Okay, oh, yeah, Mount Sinai. I was thinking of the one on 63rd,
Saint
which
Francis.
Is gone. Yeah,
Saint
yeah,
Francis,
yeah,
no,
yeah.
No,
exactly.
No, Mount Sinai.
Yeah, I never got to ask her why I was born at Mount Sinai, and I always just came up with my own story. I assume she was over there working, and at the end of the day, she had to go right in, and she probably had me before 6 o'clock. And then my other theory was, I was an experiment. You know, bring some of these folks over here so, you know, we could train some doctors at Mount Sinai. So I always thought I was like the University of Miami to Jackson Moore Hospital right now, where they practice the
experiments,
or the Miami doctors on the other folk, the people without insurance.
Your early ambition was to play in the NFL, and you started to approach that goal in Miami Beach. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I started. You know, the thing is, back then there was no organized football in Liberty City. So, you know, me being a real talented, you know, guy, and some of the other kids in my neighborhood being very talented, you know, their range, you know, Norah Optimus and Ida Fisher Junior High, they arranged for a bus to come to my back door to pick me up, me and my other friends. So they would then take us over to the beach to play organized football. You know, I played with you name it, Howie Shapiro. What's the big lawyer? His son played on the team. It'll come to me. Okay. But we were bussed over there to be able to play organized football. And I always said, hey, look, you know, if I ever make any money in my lifetime, I would then start a youth program, which I did, Liberty City Optimist, in my neighborhood, so kids would not have to go all the way to the beach and then come back home at 11, 12 o'clock at night and then just get passed along. I was being passed along in school because, you know, they just basically wanted the black kids to come over there and, you know, play football and not necessarily worried about the education. So I knew that, you know, by being in school, you know, after I got kind of wise and I got kicked out of class one day and I was walking down the hall. So I just took a peep on the other side of the hall. And I talk about this in the book. Well, the classroom, we were segregated, but then the classroom was, it was like on this side of the hall, all white kids. And then on our side of the hall was all black kids and Hispanic kids. And I was like, man. And then I used to think about it, like we was talking about in the book, that my teachers were just like, you know, like the reject teachers, you know, teachers who would be going to, like, right in the middle of class, oh, I'm going to the dog track, or I got a date outside.
So you realized you weren't being taught, you were just being used for your athletic.
Exactly. I realized that I wasn't being taught, but then, you know, I stopped playing football because I said I'm not going to be used in this way. And, you know, unfortunately, I had this great teacher, young lady named Miss Burke. And she, you know, she took a liking to me, and I said, "Look, Ms. Burke, I'm in the 10th grade right now. I can't pretty much read. You know what I'm saying? Less long is right. You know, I've been here just playing football." And she then took me, and that lady taught me how to read, taught me how to write. You know, I already know how to count.
Right.
I know how to count because of the dice games that I was having in the back.
The hustling,
exactly. But I needed to know how to read and I needed to know how to write.
We're speaking with Luther Campbell. He's a mentor, philanthropist, football coach. He's a columnist for the Miami New Times. And, of course, you probably know him from Two Live Crew, whose music was at the center of a landmark Supreme Court decision.
Former public enemy number one.
Yes, yes. He mentors in Liberty City, coaches with his Liberty City Optimist program. And he's written The Book of Luke, My Fight for Truth, Justice, and Liberty City. A short break. We'll be right back.
Sounds kind of primitive, doesn't it?
Hey, the Predator, how you doing?
Not Pam.
No, she lying. I ain't no baby daddy. She lying. I ain't her baby daddy. Come on, man. Little Black Lauren Hardy. Let me down. Come here.
Time to get right down. I-95 might see me at Onyx. Wednesday night, 4-5-6. Head crack, Monday night, 5-6. Take a trip, better go. Click Club, Chicago. Ain't no telling where I might be.
How old is this, Luke?
This song is about, probably about 15 years old. You know, and the interesting part about that, you hear the guy on there say, "Off the Heezy," that was Stuart Scott. He did, that was his first video.
Who's Stuart Scott? We're looking both kind of, our eyes are glazing over.
Stuart Scott is a great sports announcer.
Oh,
he was
on
ESPN. He just passed away from cancer.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we're speaking with, we'll resume our conversation with Luther Campbell. And he has written The Book of Luke, My Fight for Truth, Justice, and Liberty City. And that was Raise the Roof by, I guess, Two Live Crew from 15 years ago.
Nah, that was me. That was my solo album.
Oh, that's your solo album.
Yes.
See how much I know about that. Okay.
That's my job to, you know,
help to tell and fill us in. Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, someone wrote a great question here. We haven't opened the phones or the emails yet, but The next thing you did in football, you got very close with the Hurricanes. It was your favorite team.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like you to talk about that because Michael has written in, did you see steroid use while supporting University of Miami football players back then?
Really? Really? That's interesting.
It's interesting. Did you?
What was it?
If you saw any
No. I didn't see any steroid use. No. I mean, the work that I did down, you know, when I got involved with the University of Miami, and I talk about it in the book, I'm sitting here, I'm, you know, at the top of my game, big time rapper, all the young people are looking up to me, you know, college kids are now going to the University of Miami before kids in the neighborhood wouldn't go to the University of Miami. And then I start seeing these kids, you know, you're hearing the stories, oh, one just went and robbed some other students, stealing their stereo equipment and pawning it, and some of these kids are shooting up the, you know, up the campus and all that. So I just said to myself, you know, I'm just like any other concerned person. Look, if I just go down there and get involved with these guys and just talk to them about the opportunity that they have, that they can get a education out of this. And then when I got down there and I started hearing these different stories, well, man, I got a kid at home. You know, I can't get a job here because it's against NCAA rules for me to be able to get a job. And so I just took it upon myself and said, look, if you get into a situation, any of you kids, that you're getting ready to do anything crazy from the Jerome Browns, the Brett Prayermans, the Darryl Fullertons, you name it, of the world. I say, if you get ready to do something illegal, like breaking somebody's house or anything like that, and you're desperately needing of money, call me. I have no problem with that. And that is how it became, oh, Luke is paying the players.
Right, that backfired too.
That backfired.
It was backlash that you were on the sidelines.
Yeah.
And the program had a bad reputation.
Exactly. And see, and that is the story that I talk about, because how did I get on the sidelines? People like Dennis Erickson knew that, you know, I'm more like, you know, what Calvin Hill is to the Dallas Cowboys. I'm the guy who, you know, like, okay, I could talk to these guys. But coaching goes so long, so much. It's just like parenting. Parents, we could talk, but then there's always somebody that a kid will take a liking to. They'll be saying the same thing the parents are saying, but then if they're hearing it from somebody else.
Did you help in recruiting?
In recruiting? Later on down the line, when a kid would come down to Miami, and I would be like, hey, look, yeah, you want to come to Miami. It's a great place to play. But then as far as going out and saying, hey, I'm going to go and help you recruit, I'm going to knock on some doors. Now, if I'm out on South Beach and I'm walking around and a kid is on a recruiting trip, and back then, you know, not knowing the rules back then, and a kid, you know, stop by, I'll say, and you'll be like, yeah, hey, Uncle Luke, you know, because they hear the stories, they know I'm around the program, I'm getting ready to come to Miami. And then he'll be on a recruiting trip with his family. I'll be like, yeah, come to Miami. Just like any other person who's a fan of the program would encourage somebody to come. But if I do it, it's against the rules. So then I had to learn along the ways the different rules and regulations. But, you know, that was on the line. Nobody wrote that part of the story. They just said rapper on the sideline. They didn't know what I was doing on the sideline. I wasn't on the side. They don't have pockets, so you can't pay anybody on the sideline. It's, mm-hmm. Oh, it's pay for play. No, it's helping your mother. I had a kid, Lamar Thomas.
Sure.
In a quick story about him. His mother, he was living in Gainesville. His mother was getting kicked out of her house. She had then got her house foreclosed on. They had then took her clothes, took all the furniture, and put it outside while this kid was playing at the University of Miami. He was like, man, I'm getting ready to stop. I got to go home. I got to work. You know, he's from Gainesville. I got to go work to help my mom out. And I was like, hold on. I got it. Look, here's the deal. I'll go and take care. I'll help her with her house. Matter of fact, I'll just pay for whatever is needed to be paid for. You know, to get her back in the house, get her back on her feet. And whenever you make it, not knowing if he was going to make it or not, because 99.1% of them don't make it in the NFL, you just pay me back. Whether you go get a degree, get a job, if you're fortunate enough to play in the league, you pay back. You know, and that's a real man. And eventually he paid me back.
Eventually played for the Dolphins.
And he eventually played for the Dolphins. He played for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And stories like that. I mean, they don't tell that part of the story. Nowadays, you see Snoop Dogg and everybody standing on the sideline. You know, they're standing on the sideline to get TV time. I was standing on the sideline to save lives.
Luther, I want to go back a little bit more to your youth. You were a cook at Mount Sinai mm-hmm. Hospital. Now, how did you get to where you wind up being so popular, and how did you get over that?
How did I end up being
popular? You started as the DJ.
Yeah, I was. My day job was cooking, and my night job was DJing. So I was part of the group Ghetto Style DJs, and we would go all around Liberty City DJing, you know, Hollywood DJing, skating rinks, and I was pretty much the businessman of the group as well. So I went and booked the dances. I would go to Alapata Junior High and speak with the principal, Miss Jerkins, at the time, and have conversations with her, negotiate deals with her to be able to rent the cafeteria to have dances. And the same thing I did at Carroll City High. And once I made enough money to get more speakers, then I started DJing at the skating rinks. You know, and then I made more money. And I started, like I talk about in the book, I then start bringing down rap groups.
Promoting them.
Promoting rap concerts.
What did you call it? Breaking them?
Yeah.
Breaking them.
Yeah, I would, you know, because in DJing, you would get your records out of a record pool. So I would have all these stacks of records every Saturday, maybe 30 or 40 of them. And I would look for records that I thought that fit, you know, my audience would like. And then I would get on the phone and call that artist and say, I'm going to break your record down here. It's going to be a hit because I'm playing, and once you total it out from the Thursday to the Sunday, I'm playing before almost 10,000 people on the weekend. So my whole style was breaking records. And I would tell guys, hey, if I break your record, then you got to come do a free show. And unfortunately, one of those groups were Two Live Crew. They came down and do a free show, and unfortunately, one other group that I gave an idea to do a record, they wouldn't do the free show. So then I gave Two Live Crew an idea. And I said, I need you to do this song for me. And at the end of the day, they did the song, and we put it out because nobody wanted them because I didn't want to be in the music business like that. But then nobody put the record out, and then I said, well, I'll put it out myself. I believe in it because I'm going to break the record. And that's what we did, and unfortunately, we put the record out, and I talk about it in the book. Once I put it out, the record companies, it was time to get paid. And I'm sitting there saying, give me my money. And they were like, no, well, you don't know how the record business works. You got to give us another song in order for us to pay you for that last song. I was like, oh, my God, I'm stuck.
So you started your own business.
Record company.
Yeah, I had to give them another record. And then once I gave them another record, it became, man, I kind of like this. This is easy. And so I got with, you know, a couple guys, Fred Hill, Jerry Basson, all these different, and I talk about them in the book, how I maneuvered around to find out how distribution works, how marketing and promoting music works. You know, I learned that because I was an intern at 99 Jams. You know, I interned, so I knew how record promoters work as far as getting the records played on the radio, but I did not know how a record got in the store. You know, and at that time, I would be taking the records to the flea market. You know, everybody went to the flea market and get my records sold from that standpoint. And then from the flea market, then I learned about this guy, Fred Hill. God bless his soul. He taught me how distribution worked, and then I ended up starting working with Jerry Basson and them hooking me up with other distributors around the country. I'm this little record man now distributing all around the world.
But some semantics. What's the difference? Is there a difference between rap and hip-hop?
Yes, rap is much more hip-hop. The way they defined it, I don't necessarily agree with
it. Your definition.
Yeah, well, hip-hop is everything the guys did in New York. All the rappers in New York consider themselves as hip-hop. Now, when rap came in, was everybody else outside of New York, we classify as being rappers because we were considered to be outside of New York. So, you know, the Fresh Prince, they said that's not hip-hop. You know, you're not Run DMC. You're not Tila Rock. You're not in those historical hip hop groups that came out of New York. Everything outside of New York was considered as you're just rap. You're not hip hop.
They tried to keep you off stage.
Oh man, I mean those stories. Those are some wild stories.
You had to fight your
book.
Way on.
Yeah, we had to fight
literally.
Our way. Yeah, literally. Yeah, I mean, what people don't realize, and that's why I talk about it in the book, you know, the average hip-hop artist, the average person in the music business does not realize the fights. It was almost like it was a racism fight. I mean, we were guys from the South. You know, I created Southern hip-hop. And here we're thinking that we can go and perform with everybody. And now these promoters were forced to put us on the concerts. And when we would go do concerts, before you know it, what would end up happening is they would say, oh, you only have 3 minutes.
Right. And one song.
One song. And I was like, 3 minutes? And that happened like two or three times. And after that, I was like, nah, I see what this is. You know, you guys really don't want us on the show.
Luther, I really want to talk about this. We're going to get to, you know, a lot more, but the message I get from your book repeatedly, and I understand it, is that you feel underappreciated, underrecognized, not credited for not only bringing rap to South, but starting Southern hip hop, among other of your innovations, but your fights for freedom of speech, censorship, copyright use laws. Is that why you wrote this book? Do you want us to know, you know, this is who you are, this is what you've done? It wasn't just about the obscenity. It wasn't just about
Nick Navarro
being a bad boy. It was this is what you've done.
And that is the biggest misunderstanding, misconception of me. People don't know. Number one, you know, and I always say, and that's why it was important to write the book. You know, I let people say who, you know, define me in whatever way they want to define me. But I always say it when my career kind of slowed down, I'll go back and start coaching. And then I'll write a book so people could get the real story. I'm, you know, I wore the hat of being the black cowboy hat and not being the bad guy, you know. And so I wanted people to know, okay, one, this guy really ran a record company, a corporation. He started from the bootstraps and ran a corporation. But number two, he fought for free speech like no other person has ever fought. And people just don't realize that my song was the first record ever deemed obscene by a federal judge. And now just let's take that being deemed obscene. That's not me going to jail. You know, if I then said, hey, look, I'm not going to fight this to right. get this overturned, it would have just been on the record books as case law. And as we all know, what case law people, how lawyers use case laws. Any prosecutor could have used that case law in any trial by taking any record off the shelf right. that they wanted to take off the shelf. So the Lil Wayne's and all the other rappers, the Drakes of the world, you know, those guys could have been singled out and pointed out at any given time, and they'll go hip-hop because you would have case law on the book that this is what record is considered obscene. So I had to fight that case and then fight what is parody. You know, and whether parody
is Rose.
The Acuff Rose case. Now, that took me to the Supreme Court because that was a no-brainer to get the other case overturned to win that. And now I'm going up to the Supreme Court to fight a parody case.
Would you say that you are to, say, urban music what Lenny Bruce was to comedy as far as your court battles?
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. I mean, and that's why I tell people, you know, it's, you know, people who want to understand this music, the music is hip-hop is over 60 years old right now. It's not just young jitterbug music right now. You got radio stations around the country that are changing formats to just being old-school hip-hop. So, you know, like myself, I'm 54 years old. It was around long before me. So people that are 60 and 65 years old grew up on hip-hop, but a lot of those same people don't know the history and the things that I've done and what we've done here in Miami to pave the way for this music to still be lasting this long. And like I always tell people, I've always considered myself as the Rodney Dangerfield of hip hop.
You don't get the respect.
I don't get no respect. I don't get no credit. I don't nothing.
But you know what surprised me in your book is that your peers didn't support you when you were going through these battles. The one person that stepped up and let you use his song, in fact,
was Bruce Springsteen.
That was really, I mean, that was pretty surprising.
And, why was that?
That
was that, and that is still surprising to so many right now. I mean, I've been doing press on, you name it, urban stations and all, hip hop stations, and I'm talking and I tell them, you know, for the ones who read the book, they everybody finds that amazing because the Salt and Peppers back then, the Heavy D's and all these different groups of the world, again, we were outsiders. They had a problem with anything outside, and now we're selling records, you know, and they have to, they're being forced to put us on shows. And so now when the attack came, they went out on the news networks and said, this is not hip-hop. They shouldn't be doing what, put them in jail, put them in jail. And Bruce Springsteen, just like you say, he was the only one, you know, I said, look, I want to do this song Banned in the USA. I know it's Bruce Springsteen's song. So a friend of mine, David Shackler, ended up getting Bruce on the phone because he knew him. And, you know, I talked to him for 5 minutes. I talked about the conversation in the book. And long story short, he was like, look, I understand your fight. And I was able to use the song, and he didn't even charge me anything. He was like, I'm going to let you use it for free.
Every event that you staged at that time, you were being pursued by law enforcement. And tell us about the diversions you had to create on stage in order to slip out and not be arrested.
Oh, yeah. That was very funny.
Yeah. And see, those are things that people will never know unless you read a book and hear about. You know, those are some amazing stories because, you know, some of the diversions. Take, for instance, we was in Jacksonville one time. And as we went on, every municipality, you know, you had these, you had, you know, because what was going on, you had Tipper Gore and Focus on the Family, her whole organization.
Oh, yeah, Tipper Gore, right.
Al Gore's wife. You had that whole organization. Then you had the little guy, Jack Thompson, running around
Gables.
Here. The Carl Gables lawyer. And everywhere we
would
go.
You even had, well, you had Governor Martinez.
Martinez, Dan Quayle.
Dan Quayle, right.
Everybody was after us. So they would then call these different municipalities where we were performing at, and they would talk to the prosecutor and the police chief. So when we would go to these places, they would automatically, now, again, you have a federal judge just deemed the record obscene, and you know, now it was deemed obscene, and then we get it overturned, but they played like they didn't know. So if you do these lyrics, we're going to put you in jail. So they were standing on the side of the stage. And I remember one time being in Jacksonville, I said, you know what? We had pyrotechnicians in the show. I said, don't just make a bomb, just make a burst where everybody is temporarily blind. So every night we would temporarily blind everybody. I would then say, this to the police, I hate the police, and y'all ain't put me in jail, I would antagonize them, and then we'll blow up the thing, cut the lights off, I'm jumping in the audience, taking my shirt off, and hopping in people's car who I don't even know. It was some amazing stories.
There really were. Oh, Jake Thompson, you were talking about. I mean, he was disbarred, right?
Yes.
Jack Thompson.
Jack Thompson.
Yes, he was disbarred.
Yeah, okay. Yes. We haven't opened the phone yet, but... We do have a caller. Do you want to take that? Go ahead. You're welcome to Topical Currents.
Hey, it's Martha Frankel from Woodstock Writers Radio. Luther, years ago in 1990, I did a story about you for an issue of Spin Magazine that Spike Lee was editing. And it was about free speech, and it was about your lyrics. And I heard from the guy what was his name? Jack Thompson from Focus on the Family, and he was sputtering in anger that I would support your right to say this, even though, you know, my attitude was you were a comedian and this wasn't political rap. I knew that, but the vitriol and what they said, you know, rape and hate music, and that this was going to be the end, that if Luther keeps making music, women aren't safe in the streets. It's just sort of fantastic to see the book and see your career and just to see that you lasted out far beyond what they thought you would.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I didn't eventually get disbarred. And now that we're, you know, 27, 25 years away from that, You know, I see a whole, every day I go out into the world, I see people and I talk to people who are fans of Two Live Crew, fans of the music, and they're really, really well-off people. You know, doctors, lawyers, and, I mean, politicians like Keon Hardiman. He, you know, the commissioner.
We're going to get to him.
He used to dance to the, he was in a dance group dancing to the music. And so I say that to say people turned out all right. I mean, yeah. Kendrick Meeks, he was the congressman. He turned out all right.
And he listened to your music.
He listened to my music. Well, you know, so a lot of people listened to it.
It's interesting what Martha said.
In the governor's office.
Yeah, it didn't do anything wrong to him.
What Martha was said about that you're a comedian, because instead of being influenced by other musicians, you were influenced by comedians.
Yes, I was.
But your music was not seen that way. It wasn't seen as funny or comically inspired.
Yeah, and that's, you know, again, when I took on the fight and I fought, you know, the people who were trying to take the music off, I knew what the music was about. You know, I grew up, like I talk about in the book, you know, my dad, it was a musical household. Dad, on the, you know, early in the daytime, he's playing Burt Bacharach and you know, you name it. You know, it's going on in the house. What do you get for you fall in love? And so I'm just, you know, and then later on that night when the drinks get to flowing, then here come Millie Jackson. And Millie Jackson wasn't singing. She was original member of the Two Live Crew before the Two Live Crew started. And you had all these comedian albums.
How about Wild Man Steve?
Yeah, all those guys. Wild Man Steve.
The Wild Man.
Exactly. You had all that. You had Dolemite. You had Rudy Ray Moore. You had Leroy Skillet, Uneston. And those were songs that I heard as a kid while the door was supposed to be closed. And when I wanted to be different, I said, look, we're not going to be just like the guys in New York who was sampling James Brown. We're going to sample the comedy albums. And me and Mr. Mix, we did that. And it was, everything was about being funny. So when people start getting uptight and saying, oh, these guys are doing this and they're misogynistic pigs and they hate women, I'm like, huh? I love my mama, you know, and I love women. And if anything, you know, I cherish, you know. So, no, you're not talking about me. You're talking about somebody else. But
so
I
you
understood.
Were surprised by all the backlash.
Oh, yes, I was totally surprised because these things existed when you had.
Martha, yeah, anything else, Martha?
No, when I was reading the lyrics that I had quoted in that story today, and I know I can't say any of them on the air, I was dying. I mean, they're so funny, and they're just so in your face, and just really happy for you, Luther. I think it's a great book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
And that, you know, that is how we won the case when we went to jail for singing an obscene song. When we went to court, I mean, the short.
Oh, that story in the courtroom where they were reading the lyrics.
Yeah. The prosecutor read the lyrics.
That's a real parallel to Lenny Bruce.
Exactly.
Yeah, he got to do his routine.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
The prosecutor is reading he's reading the lyrics and just going hard on the lyrics and the little white lady, she was the principal, and she was sitting in there. She was turning purple. No, she was turning red, and the black people jury, they were turning purple, and the judge was like, what's wrong with you guys? You know, and they were like, can we have a moment? We need to go in the back.
This was funny. Tell this.
Yeah, they said, we need to go in the back, and the judge was like, well, why? And they were like, basically, we don't want to laugh in his face because that would be disrespectful. He said, you still need a moment? They were like, yeah, we still need a moment. And all you could hear is chatter, laughing, dying, laughing. And I said, that's a jury of my peers, and that is the intent of the music. It's funny music. It's not to be taken so serious, but I do respect uptight people's rights to get uptight and get nerves.
Right,
out.
They have freedom of speech,
they
too.
They have freedom of speech as well.
We're speaking with Luther Campbell, and, of course, his music was at the center of a landmark Supreme Court decision. He was the leader frontman of Two Live Crew, but he's a mentor, philanthropist, football coach, and more. He's written the Book of Luke. We'll be right back. Oh, good, he found it.
Doing the right thing and not the wrong. So listen up, y'all, to what we say. We won't be banned in the USA.
Be is a year old, but with all the publicity, there's a lot of people, curiosity is aroused. We're selling records to a totally different audience.
I take a precaution that nobody else has. I stick up my album, I made two versions.
The First Amendment gave us freedom of speech. To what you're saying, it didn't include me. I like to party and have a good time. There's nothing but pleasure written in our rhymes. I know you don't think we'll ever quit. We got some people on our side that won't take your lip. We're gonna do all the things we wanna do. You can't stand to see a brother get as rich as you. This is the 90s and we're coming on strong. Saying things and doing things that you're saying's wrong. Rising up, cause on election day, we'll see who's banned in the USA.
All right. And that was Banned in the USA, of course, taken from Bruce Springsteen's song by Luther Campbell. And in fact, Luther, who we're speaking to, who's written the Book of Luke, My Fight for Truth, Justice, and Liberty City, tell us about that night when you performed that. You said it was like a really, really one of your finest moments when you appeared at the MTV Music Video Awards in 1990, and you sang that.
Yes, and I talk about the experience in the book because it was like the weight of the world was lifted. I was able to, you know, because during those times, you know, MTV, BET, those networks of the world was not playing Two Live Crew, and so, you know, we had the opportunity to be able to perform. You know, and at that time, we had them basically won every case that we fought. And it was like a moment to let the world know, you know, we were banned in the USA, you know. And it was really, a lot of it was inspired by the fact that we would travel to Europe. And we would travel to Japan and different countries. And people in those countries thought it was crazy what was happening to us. So they embraced us like nobody else did. So that's when the concept of the song came to my mind, was like, we're actually banned in the USA, you know, and that's when I came up with the idea. So during that concert, you know, I cried the whole time when we performed, and everybody in that room basically felt the same thing. And, you know, and guys started coming on stage because they felt it, you know. And at that point, was the moving point of the industry now supporting us, because you'd have guys like MC Hammer jump on stage. You had Flavor Flav from Public Enemy jumped on stage at that moment. That was a serious moment for us at the time.
Now, during that Tipper Gore business, you said right up front that you had no problem with parental advisory stickers.
And you put those stickers. Records. You were the first person to do that. You did two versions, right?
Yes. And that's why I mentioned it in the book song. As well as in the song, you know, because my whole thing, the intent was not to have the music go to kids. And when the music started getting to kids, because when we made an adult version of the song, I mean, everybody in this room is aware of FCC rules and regulations and what you can say on the air and what you can't say on the air, you know. And so I know that music wasn't going on the air, so then it wasn't going to be given to the masses of kids. I never seen this music being played at a kid's skating ring or a bar mitzvah or a dance. I never imagined that.
I bet the young Luther would have found a way to get that adult version, though.
Yeah, exactly.
I think
so. Even if you weren't 18.
Right, yeah. When the big brother was playing it in the room. But again, you know, so when I did get a letter, and I talk about it in the book, when I got a letter from the PTA of Alabama, Mobile, Alabama, and they sent me a letter. They said, the kids are getting the song. What can you do? You know, and at that moment I said, look, let me create two different versions. And then I went as far as creating that sticker that you see on the records right now today. So I got parent programs coming, saying something, and then still, even with that, that did not satisfy them, you know, because they were getting so much momentum, you know, and it was a big topic. And I became, you know, you use me in an election. If you'll raise more money by saying I'm going out to the Two Live Crew.
And they were even
political.
They were even arresting record store owners. They had to go to jail.
Yeah, they started
for selling it.
Exactly. When the federal judge Gonzalez deemed the song obscene, you know, you had stores in San Antonio said no. Stores in Alabama said no. Stores in Fort Lauderdale, Freedmen said no. You know, and there were some people that just stood up and said, look, this ain't right. This is unconstitutional. We're willing to go to jail. And people were willing to go to jail. They went to jail. And the same thing with me. I said, look, I'm going to jail. Book me a club right around the corner from the courthouse that just said the song was obscene. We're going to go and perform. And Navarro, you can do what you got to do. You know, you can put us in jail.
Did you ever have a personal conversation with Nick Navarro?
Personal conversation? Nah, not really. Not really.
I have something a little serious. You know, yesterday was 1 year after Ferguson and Michael Brown. And you, in your book, talk a lot about Arthur McDuffie. And that was 35 years ago. Right up the street. Mm-hmm. And here we had more violence last night with law enforcement. Do you think things have changed much since Arthur McDuffie? And
I don't think things have changed that drastically, you know, because like I talk about in the book, I was raised up by my dad, my mom, and my uncle. And my Uncle Ricky would tell me the stories of things that would happen to him as one of the only black contractors in Miami in the 50s and the 60s. You know, and how he was disenfranchised and how he ended up going to jail because he was profiled, you know, and how, you know, blacks obviously then were getting lynched, and the stories of you know, them bringing the police from Georgia who had real serious problems with African-Americans in Georgia. They even made them the police in Miami so that they could commit those same lynching crimes against the people of Miami back then. So when you look at everything that's going on today, you know, you look at things when I grew up, you know, we sitting out there, you know, we're riding. The same thing that police did to me and people who I grew up with, it's the same thing that's going on right now. I don't say all police are bad police. It's always a few bad apples, but my biggest issue is, you know, with people in the African-American community. We don't get upset when there's black-on-black crime in our community. It's more black-on-black crime, us killing each other.
Right.
And nobody wants to tell. Then there's no snitching. You know, so we got to get our own community together first. And then, okay, fine, we deal with the police at the same time. But, you know, it's just all around, it's just too much, and it needs to be addressed, and it needs to stop.
I think we only have a couple of minutes left, so let's end on an optimistic note. You're coaching, Norris,
yes.
Okay, which is your love, coaching football. Tell us about
Central High School, right?
Miami, New Orleans.
Okay.
I started my high school career at Central.
Right. Oh, at Central, that's right.
At Central. Then I went to Miami Northwest, and I got a job with the great Billy Rowe. He asked me to be the defense coordinator over there, and he left. He basically got fired, so, you know, I stayed another year, and I left eventually, and now I'm at Miami Norland helping the kids out over there. But the most proud of thing that I am proud of is my youth program that I founded with Sam Johnson, Liberty City Optimist. That this year is our 25th year, and we have some great kids from Duke Johnson to Devontae Friedman to Chad Johnson. You name it. We've had some great kids that came
Where's
out
Darrell
of the program.
Where's Darrell Eskridge?
He's playing for the New York Jets.
He is?
Yeah.
And he came right out of your program.
Yeah, the one who I'm proud of the most is the Commissioner Keon Hardeman, because
okay.
He came out
and
of our
I want
program
you to talk,
as well.
Okay, and he is a city commissioner now, and he just did something with Charles Hadley Park, right?
Yes. I mean, he's doing so many great things in the neighborhood because, again, he wasn't put in by the special interest groups. He was put in by us going out, you know, going door to door. So we have a new youth center, $6.5 million center, putting a gymnasium on Hadley Park, you know, revitalizing the senior citizen home. So he's doing some great things in the community.
Which you've wanted to do for a long time with that
yes,
Hadley
yes,
Park.
Yes.
That was the only safe place in Liberty City for a
exactly.
long time.
Exactly.
Well, we're almost out of time.
Well, it's too bad that we're almost out of time.
Very
Paul, when
fun.
We're going out, can we hear Band in the USA again? Okay.
Oh, you don't get up and dance now.
I'm almost doing it. You're not. We'll do it together. Okay. Luther Campbell, mentor, philanthropist, football coach. He's a columnist for the Miami New Times. And he mentors in Liberty City and coaches with his Liberty City Optimist program and coaches football at Norland High School. And his book is The Book of Luke, My Fight for Truth, Justice, and Liberty City. And it's a great book. And thank you so much, Luther, for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in. Our program was produced by Richard Ive, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. Reminder, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's Topical Currents is with North Florida University political science professor Matthew Corrigan. As Republicans sort out their 2016 presidential slate, Corrigan has written about one who served two terms as Florida governor, Jeb Bush. Corrigan is the author of Conservative Hurricane, How Jeb Bush Remade Florida. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.
We have the freedom of choice, and you, Chinese, black, green, purple, Jew, you have the right to listen to whoever you want to, and even the Two Live Crew, Two Live Crew, Two Live Crew. So all you right-wingers, left-wingers, bigots, communists, there is a place for you in this world, because this is the land of the free, the home of the